I, Shanghaied. This is to be a story of a battle, at least one murder, and several sudden deaths. For that reason it begins with a pink tea, and among the mingled odors of many delicate perfumes and the hale, frank smell of Caroline Testout roses. There had been a great number of debutantes coming out that season in San Francisco by means of afternoon teas, pink, lavender, and otherwise. This particular tea was intended to celebrate the fact that Josie Herrick had arrived at that time of her life when she was to wear her hair high and her gowns long, and to have a day of her own quite distinct from that of her mother. Ross Wilbur presented himself at the Herrick house on Pacific Avenue much too early upon the afternoon of Miss Herrick's tea. As he made his way up the canvas stairs, he was aware of a terrifying array of millinery and a disquieting staccato chatter of feminine voices in the parlors and reception rooms on either side of the hallway. A single hi-hat in the room that had been set apart for the men's use confirmed him in his suspicions. "Might have known it would be a hen party till six, anyhow," he muttered, swinging out of his overcoat. "Bet I don't know one girl and 20 down there now, all Mama's friends at this hour, and Papa's maiden sisters, and Joe's schoolteachers and governesses and music teachers, and I don't know what all." When he went down he found it precisely as he expected. He went up to Miss Herrick, where she stood receiving with her mother and two of the other girls, and allowed them to chaff him on his forlornness. "Maybe I seem at my ease," said Ross Wilbur to them, "but really I am very much frightened. I'm going to run away as soon as it is decently possible, even before, unless you feed me." "I believe you had luncheon not 2 hours ago," said Miss Herrick. "Come along, though, and I'll give you some chocolate, and perhaps, if you're good, a stuffed olive. I got them just because I knew you liked them. I ought to stay here and receive, so I can't look after you for long." The two fought their way through the crowded rooms to the luncheon table, and Miss Herrick got Wilbur his chocolate and his stuffed olives. They sat down and talked in a window recess for a moment, Wilbur toeing in an absurd fashion as he tried to make a lap for his plate. "I thought," said Miss Herrick, "that you were going on the Ridgeways' yachting party this afternoon. Mrs. Ridgeway said she was counting on you. They are going out with the Petrel." "She didn't count above 100, though," answered Wilbur. "I got your bid first, so I regretted the yachting party, and I guess I'd have regretted it anyhow," and he grinned at her over his cup. "Nice man," she said, adding on the instant, "I must go now, Ross." "Wait till I eat the sugar out of my cup," complained Wilbur. "Tell me," he added, scraping vigorously at the bottom of the cup with the inadequate spoon, "tell me, you're going to the hoedown tonight?"
"If you mean the assembly, yes, I am."
"Will you give me the first and last?"
"I'll give you the first, and you can ask for the last then."
"Let's put it down, I know you'll forget it." Wilbur drew a couple of cards from his case. "Programs are not good form anymore," said Miss Herrick. "Forgetting a dance is worse." He made out the cards, writing on the one he kept for himself, "First Waltz Joe."
"I must go back now," said Miss Herrick, getting up.
"In that case I shall run, I'm afraid of girls."
"It's a pity about you."
"I am, one girl, I don't say, but girl in the aggregate like this," and he pointed his chin toward the thronged parlors. "It unmans me."
"Goodbye, then."
"Goodbye, until tonight, about?"
"About 9.
"About 9, then." Ross Wilbur made his adieu to Mrs. Herrick and the girls who were receiving, and took himself away. As he came out of the house and stood for a moment on the steps, settling his hat gingerly upon his hair so as not to disturb the parting, he was not by any means an ill-looking chap. His good height was helped out by his long coat and his high silk hat, and there was plenty of jaw in the lower part of his face. Nor was his tailor altogether answerable for his shoulders. 3 years before this time Ross Wilbur had pulled at number 5 in his varsity boat in an eastern college that was not accustomed to athletic discomfiture. "I wonder what I'm going to do with myself until supper time," he muttered, as he came down the steps, feeling for the middle of his stick. He found no immediate answer to his question. But the afternoon was fine, and he set off to walk in the direction of the town, with a half-formed idea of looking in at his club. At his club he found a letter in his box from his particular chum, who had been spending the month shooting elk in Oregon. "Dear old man," it said, "we'll be back on the afternoon you receive this. We'll hit the town on the 3 o'clock boat. Get seats for the best show going my treat and arrange to assimilate nutriment at the poodle dog also mine. I've got miles of talk in me that I've got to reel off before midnight. Yours, Jerry." "I've got a stand of horns for you, Ross, that are glory hallelujah." "Well, I can't go," murmured Wilbur, as he remembered the assembly that was to come off that night and his engaged dance with Joe Herrick.
He decided that it would be best to meet Jerry as he came off the boat and tell him how matters stood. Then he resolved, since no one that he knew was in the club, and the installment of the Paris Weeklies had not arrived, that it would be amusing to go down to the waterfront and loaf among the shipping until it was time for Jerry's boat. Wilbur spent an hour along the wharves, watching the great grain ships consigned to Cork for orders slowly gorging themselves with whole harvests of wheat from the San Joaquin Valley, lumber vessels for Durban and South African ports settling lower and lower to the water's level as forests of pine and redwood stratified themselves along their decks and in their holds, coal barges discharging from Nanaimo, busy little tugs coughing and nuzzling at the flanks of the deep-sea tramps, while hay barges and Italian Whitehalls came and went at every turn. A Stockton River boat went by, her stern wheel churning along behind, like a huge net reel, a tiny maelstrom of activity centered about an Alaska Commercial Company's steamboat that would clear for Dawson in the morning. No quarter of one of the most picturesque cities in the world had more interest for Wilbur than the waterfront. In the mile or so of shipping that stretched from the docks where the China steamships landed, down past the ferry slips and onto Meigs's Wharf, every maritime nation in the world was represented. More than once Wilbur had talked to the loungers of the wharves, stevedores out of work, sailors between voyages, caulkers and ship chandlers, men looking not too earnestly for jobs, so that on this occasion, when a little, undersized fellow in dirty brown sweater and clothes of Barbary Coast cut asked him for a match to light his pipe, Wilbur offered a cigar and passed the time of day with him. Wilbur had not forgotten that he himself was dressed for an afternoon function. But the incongruity of the business was precisely what most amused him. After a time the fellow suggested drinks. Wilbur hesitated for a moment. It would be something to tell about, however, so, all right, I'll drink with you, he said. The brown sweater led the way to a sailor's boarding house hard by. The rear of the place was built upon piles over the water. But in front, on the ground floor, was a bar room. Rum and gum, announced the brown sweater, as the two came in and took their places at the bar. Rum and gum, Tuck, what'll you have, sir? Oh, I don't know, hesitated Wilbur, give me a mild Manhattan. While the drinks were being mixed, the brown sweater called Wilbur's attention to a fighting headdress from the Marquesas that was hung on the wall over the free lunch counter in opposite the bar. Wilbur turned about to look at it, and remained so, his back to the barkeeper, till the latter told them their drinks were ready. Well, mate, here's big blocks and tauntaun's pipes, said the brown sweater cordially. Your very good health, returned Wilbur. The brown sweater wiped a thin mustache in the hollow of his palm, and wiped that palm upon his trouser leg. Yes, sir, he continued, once more facing the Marquesas headdress. Yes, sir, they're queer game down there. In the Marquesas Islands, you mean? Said Wilbur. Yes, sir, they're queer game. When they ain't tattooing theirselves with scripture texts they get from the missionaries, they're pulling out the hairs all over their bodies with two clamshells. Hair by hair, why understand? Pulling out her hair? Said Wilbur, wondering what was the matter with his tongue. They think it's clever, think the women folk like it. Wilbur had fancied that the little man had worn a brown sweater when they first met. But now, strangely enough, he was not in the least surprised to see it iridescent like a pigeon's breast. Why ever been down that way? Inquired the little man next. Wilbur heard the words distinctly enough, but somehow they refused to fit into the right places in his brain. He pulled himself together, frowning heavily. What did you say? He asked with great deliberation, biting off his words. Then he noticed that he and his companion were no longer in the barroom, but in a little room back of it. His personality divided itself. There was one Ross Wilbur who could not make his hands go where he wanted them, who said one word when he thought another, and whose legs below the knee were made of solid lead. Then there was another Ross Wilbur, the alert, who was perfectly clear-headed, and who stood off to one side and watched his twin brother making a monkey of himself, without power and without even the desire of helping him. This latter Wilbur heard the iridescent sweater say. Bust me, if y ain't squiffy, old man. Stand by a bit and we'll have a ball. Can't have got return exceptionally in the round table pull out hairs y two clamshells, gabbled Wilbur's stupefied double, and Wilbur the alert said to himself, you're not drunk, Ross Wilbur, that's certain, what could they have put in your cocktail? The iridescent sweater stamped twice upon the floor and a trapdoor fell away beneath Wilbur's feet like the drop of a gallows. With the eyes of his undrugged self, Wilbur had a glimpse of water below. His elbow struck the floor as he went down, and he fell feet first into a Whitehall boat. He had time to observe two men at the oars and to look between the piles that supported the house above him and catch a glimpse of the bay and a glint of the Contra Costa shore. He was not in the least surprised at what had happened, and made up his mind that it would be a good idea to lie down in the boat and go to sleep. Suddenly, but how long after his advent into the boat he could not tell, his wits began to return and settle themselves, like wild birds flocking again after a scare. Swiftly he took in the scene. The blue waters of the bay around him, the deck of a schooner on which he stood, the white hull boat alongside, and an enormous man with a face like a setting moon wrangling with his friend in the sweater no longer iridescent. "What do you call it?" shouted the red man. "I want able seamen. I don't figure on working this boat with dancing masters, do I? We ain't exactly doing quadrilles on my quarterdeck. If we don't look out, we'll step on this thing and break it. It ain't taught to be let around loose without its ma." "Rot that," vociferated the brown sweater. "I tell you he's one of the best sailor men on the front. If he ain't, we'll forfeit the money. Come on, Captain Kitchell, we made show enough getting away as it was, and this daytime business ain't our line. Do you sign or not? Here's the advance note. I got to duck my nut or I'll have the patrol boat after me." "I'll sign this once," growled the other, scrawling his name on the note, "but if this swab ain't up to sample, he'll come back by freight, and I'll drop in on me dear friend Jim when we come back and give him a real nice time, and you can lay to that, Billy Trim." The brown sweater pocketed the note, went over the side, and rowed off. Wilbur stood in the waist of a schooner anchored in the stream well off Fisherman's Wharf. In the forward part of the schooner a Chinaman in brown duck was mixing paint. Wilbur was conscious that he still wore his high hat and long coat, but his stick was gone and one gray glove was slipped to the button. In front of him towered the enormous red-faced man. A pungent reek of some kind of rancid fat or oil assailed his nostrils. Over by Alcatraz a ferryboat whistled for its slip as it elbowed its way through the water. Wilbur had himself fairly in hand by now. His wits were all about him, but the situation was beyond him as yet. "Get forward," commanded the big man. Wilbur drew himself up, angry in an instant. "Look here," he began, "what's the meaning of this business? I know I've been drugged and mishandled. I demand to be put ashore. Do you understand that?" "Angel child," whimpered the big man. "Oh, you lily of the valley, you bright and morning star. I'm really pain you know, that your valley can't come along, but we'll have your piano set up in the lazarette. It gives me genuine grief, it do, to see you being obliged to put your lily white feet on this here vulgar and dirty deck. We'll have the Wilton carpet down by tomorrow, so we will, my dear. Yih!" he suddenly broke out, as his rage boiled over. "Get forward, do you hear? I'm captain of this here bathtub, and that's all you need to know for a good while to come. I ain't generally got to tell that to a man but once, but I'll stretch the point just for love of you, angel child. Now, then, move." Wilbur stood motionless, puzzled beyond expression. No experience he had ever been through helped in this situation. "Look here," he began, "I—" The captain knocked him down with a blow of one enormous fist upon the mouth, and while he was yet stretched upon the deck kicked him savagely in the stomach. Then he allowed him to rise, caught him by the neck and the slack of his overcoat, and ran him forward to where a hatchway, not 2 feet across, opened in the deck. Without ado, he flung him down into the darkness below, and while Wilbur, dizzied by the fall, sat on the floor at the foot of the vertical companion ladder, gazing about him with distended eyes, there rained down upon his head, first an oilskin coat, then a sou'wester, a pair of oilskin breeches, woolen socks, and a plug of tobacco. Above him, down the contracted square of the hatch, came the bellowing of the captain's voice. "There's your fit out, Mr. Lily of the Valley, which the same our dear friend Jim makes a present of and no charge, because he loves you so. You are allowed 2 minutes to change, and it is to be hoped as how you won't force me to come for to assist." It would have been interesting to have followed, step by step, the mental process that now took place in Ross Wilbur's brain. The captain had given him 2 minutes in which to change. The time was short enough, but even at that Wilbur changed more than his clothes during the 2 minutes he was left to himself in the reek and dark of the schooner's forecastle. It was more than a change, it was a revolution. What he made up his mind to do, precisely what mental attitude he decided to adopt, just what new niche he elected wherein to set his feet, it is difficult to say. Only by results could the change be guessed at. He went down the forward hatch at the toe of Kitchell's boot, silk-hatted, melt-and-overcoated, patent-booted, and gloved in suede. 2 minutes later there emerged upon the deck a figure in oilskins and a sou'wester. There was blood upon the face of him and the grime of an unclean ship upon his bare hands. It was Wilbur, and yet not Wilbur. In 2 minutes he had been, in a way, born again. The only traces of his former self were the patent leather boots, still persistent in their gloss and shine, that showed grim incongruity below the vast compass of the oilskin breeches. As Wilbur came on deck, he saw the crew of the schooner hurrying forward, six of them, Chinamen every one, in brown jeans and black felt hats. On the quarterdeck stood the captain, barking his orders. "Consider the Lily of the Valais," bellowed the latter, as his eye fell upon Wilbur the transformed. "Clap onto that starboard windlass brake, sonny." Wilbur saw the Chinamen ranging themselves about what he guessed was the windlass in the schooner's bow. He followed and took his place among them, grasping one of the bars. "Break down," came the next order. Wilbur and the Chinaman obeyed, bearing up and down upon the bars till the slack of the anchor chain came home and stretched taut and dripping from the hawse holes. Vast heaven! And then as Wilbur released the brake and turned about for the next order, he cast his glance out upon the bay, and there, not 150 yards away, her spotless sails tense, her cordage humming, her immaculate flag slipping easily through the waves, the water hissing and churning under her forefoot, clean, gleaming, dainty, and aristocratic, the Ridgway's yacht Petrel passed like a thing of life. Wilbur saw Nat Ridgway himself at the wheel. Girls in smart gowns and young fellows in white ducks and yachting caps, all friends of his, crowded the decks. A little orchestra of musicians were reeling off a quickstep. The popping of a cork and a gale of talk and laughter came to his ears. Wilbur stared at the picture, his face devoid of expression. The Petrel came on nearer, was not 100 feet away from the schooner's stern. A strong swimmer, such as Wilbur, could cover the distance in a few strides. 2 minutes ago Wilbur might have. "Set your mainsail," came the bellow of Captain Kitchell. "Clap onto your throat and peak halyards." The Chinamen hurried aft. Wilbur followed, too. A nautical education. In the course of the next few moments, while the little vessel was being got under way, and while the Ridgway's Petrel gleamed off into the blue distance, Wilbur made certain observations. The name of the boat on which he found himself was the Bertha Milner. She was a 2-topmast, 28-ton keel schooner, 40 feet long, carrying a large spread of sail, mainsail, foresail, jib, flying jib, 2 gaff topsails, and a staysail. She was very dirty and smelt abominably of some kind of rancid oil. Her crew were Chinamen, there was no mate. But the cook himself, a Chinaman who appeared from time to time at the door of the galley, a potato masher in his hand, seemed to have some sort of authority over the hands. He acted in a manner as a go-between for the captain and the crew, sometimes interpreting the former's orders, and occasionally giving one of his own. Wilbur heard the captain address him as Charlie. He spoke pidgin English fairly. Of the balance of the crew, the 5 Chinamen, Wilbur could make nothing. They never spoke, neither to Captain Kitchell, to Charlie, nor to each other, and for all the notice they took of Wilbur, he might easily have been a sack of sand. Wilbur felt that his advent on the Bertha Milner was by its very nature an extraordinary event, but the absolute indifference of these brown-suited Mongols, the blankness of their flat, fat faces, the dullness of their slanting, fish-like eyes that never met his own or even wandered in his direction, was uncanny, disquieting. In what strange venture was he now to be involved? Toward what unknown vortex was this new current setting, this current that had so suddenly snatched him from the solid ground of his accustomed life? He told himself grimly that he was to have a free cruise up the bay, perhaps as far as Alviso, perhaps the Bertha Milner would even make the circuit of the bay before returning to San Francisco. He might be gone a week. Wilbur could already see the scare heads of the daily papers the next morning, chronicling the disappearance of one of society's most popular members. "That's well, your throat halyards. Here, Lily of the Valais, give a couple of pulls on your peak halyard purchase." Wilbur stared at the captain helplessly. "No can tell, hey?" inquired Charlie from the galley. "Pull 'em diesel ope, sabe?" Wilbur tugged at the rope the cook indicated. "That's well, your peak halyard purchase," chanted Captain Kitchell. Wilbur made the rope fast. The mainsail was set, and hung slatting and flapping in the wind. Next the foresail was set in much the same manner, and Wilbur was ordered to lay out on the jibboom and cast the gaskets off the jib. He lay out as best he could and cast off the gaskets. He knew barely enough of yachting to understand an order here and there, and by the time he was back on the fo'sle head the Chinamen were at the jib halyard and hoisting away. "That's well, your jib halyards." The Bertha Milner veered round and played off to the wind, tugging at her anchor. "Man your windlass." Wilbur and the crew jumped once more to the brakes. "Break down, heave your anchor to the cathead." The anchor chain, already taut, vibrated and then cranked through the hawse holes as the hands rose and fell at the brakes. The anchor came home, dripping gray slime. A nor'west wind filled the schooner's sails, a strong ebb tide caught her underfoot. "We're off," muttered Wilbur, as the Bertha Milner heeled to the first gust. But evidently the schooner was not bound up the bay. Must be Vallejo or Benicia, then, hazarded Wilbur, as the sails grew tenser and the water rippled ever louder under the schooner's forefoot. Maybe they're going after hay or wheat. The schooner was tacking, headed directly for Meigs's wharf. She came in closer and closer, so close that Wilbur could hear the talk of the fishermen sitting on the string pieces. He had just made up his mind that they were to make a landing there, when "Stand by for stays," came the raucous bark of the captain, who had taken on the heel. The sails slatted furiously as the schooner came about. Then the Bertha Milner caught the wind again and lay over quietly and contentedly to her work. The next tack brought the schooner close under Alcatraz. The sea became heavier, the breeze grew stiff and smelled of the outside ocean. Out beyond them to westward opened the Golden Gate, a bleak vista of gray-green water roughened with whitecaps. "Stand by for stays." Once again as the rudder went hard over, the Bertha Milner fretted and danced and shook her sails, calling impatiently for the wind, chafing at its absence like a child reft of a toy. Then again she scooped the nor'wester in the hollow palms of her tense canvases and settled quietly down on the new tack, her bowsprit pointing straight toward the Presidio. "We'll come about again soon," Wilbur told himself, "and stand over toward the Contra Costa shore." A fine huge breath of wind passed over the schooner. She heeled it on the instant, the water roaring along her quarter, but she kept her course. Wilbur fell thoughtful again, never more keenly observant. "She must come about soon," he muttered uneasily, "if she's going to stand up toward Vallejo." His heart sank with a sudden apprehension. A nervousness he could not overcome seized upon him. The Bertha Milner held tenaciously to the tack. Within 50 yards of the Presidio came the command again. "Stand by for stays." Once more, her bows dancing, her cordage rattling, her sails flapping noisily, the schooner came about. Anxiously Wilbur observed the bowsprit as it circled like a hand on a dial, watching where now it would point. It wavered, fluctuated, rose, fell, then settled easily, pointing toward Lime Point. Wilbur felt a sudden coldness at his heart. "This isn't going to be so much fun," he muttered between his teeth. The schooner was not bound up the bay for Alviso nor to Vallejo for grain. The track toward Lime Point could mean but one thing. The wind was freshening from the northwest, the ebb tide rushing out to meet the ocean like a mill race. At every moment the Golden Gate opened out wider, and within 2 minutes after the time of the last tack the Bertha Milner heeled to a great gust that had come booming in between the heads, straight from the open Pacific. "Stand by for stays." As before, one of the Chinese hands stood by the sail rope of the jib. "Draw your jib." The jib filled. The schooner came about on the port tack, Lime Point fell away over the stern rail. The huge ground swells began to come in, and as she rose and bowed to the first of these it was precisely as though the Bertha Milner were making her courtesy to the great gray ocean, now for the first time in full sight on her starboard quarter. The schooner was beating out to sea through the middle channel. Once clear of the Golden Gate, she stood over toward the cliff house, then on the next tack cleared Point Bonita. The sea began building up in deadly earnest. They were about to cross the bar. Everything was battened down, the scuppers were awash, and the hawse holes spouted like fountains after every plunge. Once the captain ordered all men aloft, just in time to escape a gigantic dull green roller that broke like a Niagara over the schooner's bows, smothering the decks knee-deep in a twinkling. The wind blew violent and cold, the spray was flying like icy small shot. Without intermission the Bertha Milner rolled and plunged and heaved and sank. Wilbur was drenched to the skin and sore in every joint, from being shunted from rail to mast and from mast to rail again. The cordage sang like harp strings, the schooner's forefoot crushed down into the heaving water with a hissing like that of steam, blocks rattled, the captain bellowed his orders, rope ends flogged the hollow deck till it reverberated like a drumhead. The crossing of the bar was one long half-hour of confusion and discordant sound. When they were across the bar the captain ordered the cook to give the men their food. "Get forward, sonny," he added, fixing Wilbur with his eye. "Get forward, this is table d'hote, savvy?" Wilbur crawled forward on the reeling deck, holding on now to a mast, now to a belaying pin, now to a stay, watching his chance and going on between the inebriated plunges of the schooner. He descended the fo'c'sle hatch. The Chinamen were already there, sitting on the edges of their bunks. On the floor, at the bottom of the ladder, punk sticks were burning in an old tomato can. Charlie brought in supper stewed beef and pork in a bread pan and a wooden kit, and the Chinamen ate in silence with their sheathed knives and from tin plates. A liquid that bore a distant resemblance to coffee was served. Wilbur learned afterward to know the stuff as blackjack, and to be aware that it was made from bud barley and was sweetened with molasses. A single reeking lamp swung with the swinging of the schooner over the center of the group, and long after Wilbur could remember the grisly scene, the punk sticks, the bread pan full of hunks of meat, the horrid close and oily smell, and the circle of silent, preoccupied Chinese, each sitting on his bunk ledge, devouring stewed pork and holding his pannikin of blackjack between his feet against the rolling of the boat. Wilbur looked fearfully at the mess in the pan, recalling the chocolate and stuffed olives that had been his last luncheon. "Well," he muttered, clenching his teeth, "I've got to come to it sooner or later." His penknife was in the pocket of his waistcoat, underneath his oilskin coat. He opened the big blade, harpooned a cube of pork, and deposited it on his tin plate. He ate it slowly and with savage determination. But the blackjack was more than he could bear. "I'm not hungry enough for that just now," he told himself. "Say, Jim," he said, turning to the Chinaman next to him on the bunk ledge, "say, what kind of boat is this? What you do where you go?" The other moved away impatiently. "No sabe, no sabe," he answered, shaking his head and frowning. Throughout the whole of that strange meal these were the only words spoken. When Wilbur came on deck again he noted that the Bertha Milner had already left the whistling buoy astern. Off to the east, her sails just showing above the waves, was a pilot boat with the number 7 on her mainsail. The evening was closing in, the Farallones were in plain sight dead ahead. Far behind, in a mass of shadow just bluer than the sky, he could make out a few twinkling lights San Francisco. Half an hour later Kitchell came on deck from his supper in the cabin aft. He glanced in the direction of the mainland, now almost out of sight, then took the wheel from one of the Chinamen and commanded, "Ease off your fore and main sheets." The hands eased away and the schooner played off before the wind. The staysail was set. The Bertha Milner headed to southwest, bowling easily ahead of a good 8-knot breeze. Next came the order all hands aft. And Wilbur and his mates betook themselves to the quarterdeck. Charlie took the wheel, and he and Kitchell began to choose the men for their watches, just as Wilbur remembered to have chosen sides for baseball during his school days. "Sonny, I'll choose you, you're on my watch," said the captain to Wilbur, "and I will assume the responsibility of your nautical education." "I may as well tell you at once," began Wilbur, "that I'm no sailor." "But you will be, soon," answered the captain, at once soothing and threatening. "You will be, Mr. Lily of the Valet, you can lay to it as how you will be one of the best sailormen along the front, as our dear friend Jim says. Before I get through with you, you'll be a sailorman or shark bait, I can promise you. You're on my watch, step over here, son." The watches were divided, Charlie and three other Chinamen on the port, Kitchell, Wilbur, and two Chinamen on the starboard. The men trooped forward again. The tiny world of the schooner had lapsed to quiet. The Bertha Milner was now clear of the land, that lay like a blur of faintest purple smoke ever growing fainter low in the east. The Farallones showed but their shoulders above the horizon. The schooner was standing well out from shore even beyond the track of the coasters and passenger steamers to catch the trades from the northwest. The sun was setting royally, and the floor of the ocean shimmered like mosaic. The sea had gone down and the fury of the bar was a thing forgotten. It was perceptibly warmer. On board, the two watches mingled forward, smoking opium and playing a game that looked like checkers. Three of them were washing down the decks with kire brooms. For the first time since he had come on board Wilbur heard the sound of their voices. The evening was magnificent. Never to Wilbur's eyes had the Pacific appeared so vast, so radiant, so divinely beautiful. A star or two burned slowly through that part of the sky where the pink began to fade into the blue. Charlie went forward and set the side lights red on the port rigging, green on the starboard. As he passed Wilbur, who was leaning over the rail and watching the phosphorus flashing just under the surface, he said, "Hey, you go talky talk one PC boss, savvy boss chin chin." Wilbur went aft and came up on the poop, where Kitchell stood at the wheel, smoking an inverted terrier's delight. "Now, son," began Kitchell, "I naturally love you so that I'm going to do you a real favor, do you twig? I'm going to allow you to berth aft in the cabin, long o' me and Charlie, and besides you can make free of my quarterdeck. Mebby you ain't used to the ways of sailormen just yet, but you can lay to it that those two are real concessions, savvy? I ain't a mushhead, like me dear friend Jim. You ain't no waterfront swine, I can guess that with one hand tied behind me. You're a toff, that's what you are, and your lines has been laid for toffs. I ain't asking you no questions, but you got brains, and I figure on getting more out of you by letting you have your head a bit. But mind, now, you get gay once, sonny, or try to flimfly me, or forget that I'm the boss of the bathtub, and strike me blind, I'll cut you open, and you can lay to that, son. Now, then, here's the game, You work this boat long with the coolies, and take my orders, and walk shock, and I'll teach you navigation, and make this cruise as easy as how do you do. You don't, and I'll manhandle you till your bones come through your hide.
I've no choice in the matter, said Wilbur. I've got to make the best of a bad situation.
I remarked as how you had brains, muttered the captain. But there's one thing, continued Wilbur, if I'm to have my head a little, as you say, you'll find we can get along better if you put me to rights about this whole business. Why was I brought aboard? Why are there only Chinese along? Where are we going? What are we going to do? And how long are we going to be gone?
Kitchell spat over the side, and then sucked the nicotine from his mustache.
Well, he said, resuming his pipe, it's like this, son. This ship belongs to one of the six Chinese companies of Chinatown in Frisco. Charlie, here, is one of the shareholders in the business. We go down here twice a year off Cape San Lucas, Lower California, and fish for blue sharks, or white, if we can catch them. We get the livers of these and try out the oil, and we bring back that same oil, and the Chinamen sell it all over San Francisco as Simon Pure Cod Liver Oil, savvy? And it pays like a nitrate bed. I come in because it's a custom house regulation that no coolie can take a boat out of Frisco.
And how do I come in? Asked Wilbur.
Me dear friend Jim put a knock-me-out drop into your Manhattan cocktail. It's a capsule filled with a drug.
You were shanghaied, son, said the captain, blandly.
About an hour later Wilbur turned in. Kitchell showed him his bunk with its donkey's breakfast and single ill-smelling blanket. It was located under the companionway that led down into the cabin. Kitchell bunked on one side, Charlie on the other. A hack deal table, covered with oilcloth and iron to the floor, a swinging lamp, two chairs, a rack of books, a chest or two, and a flaring picture cut from the advertisement of a ballet, was the room's inventory in the matter of furniture and ornament. Wilbur sat on the edge of his bunk before undressing, reviewing the extraordinary events of the day. In a moment he was aware of a movement in one of the other two bunks, and presently made out Charlie lying on his side and holding in the flame of an alcohol lamp a skewer on which some brown and sticky stuff boiled and sizzled. He transformed the stuff to the bowl of a huge pipe and drew on it noisily once or twice. In another moment he had sunk back in his bunk, nearly senseless, but with a long breath of an almost blissful contentment.
Beast! Muttered Wilbur, with profound disgust. He threw off his oilskin coat and felt in the pocket of his waistcoat, which he had retained when he had changed his clothes in the fo'c'sle, for his watch. He drew it out. It was just 9 o'clock. All at once an idea occurred to him. He fumbled in another pocket of the waistcoat and brought out one of his calling cards. For a moment Wilbur remained motionless, seated on the bunk ledge, smiling grimly, while his glance wandered now to the sordid cabin of the Bertha Milner and the opium-drugged coolie sprawled on the donkey's breakfast, and now to the card in his hand on which a few hours ago he had written.
First Waltz Joe, 3. The Lady. Another day passed, then two. Before Wilbur knew it he had settled himself to his new life, and woke one morning to the realization that he was positively enjoying himself. Daily the weather grew warmer. The fifth day out from San Francisco it was actually hot. The pitch grew soft in the Bertha Milner's deck seams, the mast sweated resin. The Chinamen went about the decks wearing but their jeans and blouses. Kitchell had long since abandoned his coat and vest. Wilbur's oilskins became intolerable, and he was at last constrained to trade his pocket knife to Charlie for a suit of jeans and wicker sandals, such as the coolies wore and odd enough he looked in them. The captain instructed him in steering, and even promised to show him the use of the sextant and how to take an observation in the fake short and easy coasting style of navigation. Furthermore, he showed him how to read the log and the manner of keeping the dead reckoning. During most of his watches Wilbur was engaged in painting the inside of the cabin, door panels, lintels, and the few scattered moldings, and toward the middle of the first week out, when the Bertha Milner was in the latitude of Point Conception, he and three Chinamen, under Kitchell's directions, ratlined down the fore rigging and affixed the crow's nest upon the foremast. The next morning, during Charlie's watch on deck, a Chinaman was sent up into the crow's nest, and from that time on there was always a lookout maintained from the masthead. More than once Wilbur looked around him at the empty coruscating indigo of the ocean floor, wondering at the necessity of the lookout, and finally expressed his curiosity to Kitchell. The captain had now taken not a little to Wilbur, at first for the sake of a white man's company, and afterward because he began to place a certain vague reliance upon Wilbur's judgment. Kitchell had remarked as how he had brains.
Well, you see, son, Kitchell had explained to Wilbur, ostensibly we are after shark liver oil and so we are.